Hi, my name is Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this podcast, we discuss subjects that might be creepy to some and sometimes even frightening. Some of our episodes will deal with serious subject matter, while others will be more lighthearted. Please keep in mind that I am not an expert on any of the topics I cover, just an interested party, and as always, listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone, and welcome back. I'm Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. I hope some of our listeners had the chance to tune into the Halloween special. I know it was informal and a little more chit-chatty than what we usually do, but I do hope it was entertaining. We had fun putting it together, and I'd love to hear your feedback about it to give me some ideas for what we should be doing next year. Send me a message on the Facebook group or through Instagram. You can reach us at crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com. Just let me know your thoughts. Tonight, I'm recording solo. All my wonderful co-hosts helped me out on the Halloween episode, so I wanted to give them a little bit of a break, and it was kind of a crunch to get this one recorded for Sunday. So to give them that break, I'll be on my own tonight. I hope you enjoy. Back in June 2014, Canadians woke up to some shocking news. A young boy, Nathan O'Brien, who was 5, and his grandparents, Kathy and Alvin Lickniz, had gone missing from their Calgary home overnight. Kathy and Alvin had been having an estate sale the day before they all went missing. They were planning to spend most of their time between Mexico and a house they had bought in Edmonton, and were preparing for that move, according to a 2017 CBC article. Their daughter Jennifer and her two youngest sons, Nathan, who is 5, and her 1-year-old son as well, were at the Lickniz's that day and had decided to spend the night. Jennifer would later say that she enjoyed spending that day with her parents and that her mother was her best friend. During the night, her youngest son, who was just 1 year old, had woken up, and Jennifer decided to head home with him, leaving Nathan to stay with his grandparents. The next morning, she tried to call her parents to let them know she was coming over, but got no answer. So then she just headed over to their house, but as soon as she stepped in, she was greeted with a horrible scene. According to the CBC article, she immediately knew that something terrible had happened and told her husband, "My family has been murdered and he's taken the bodies." All over the house, there were clear signs of a struggle. Objects were overturned, there was blood through the house, and bloody handprints on the walls. I can't even imagine the feeling of walking into a scene like that. The police were called in, and later that day, an Amber Alert was issued for Nathan. The police notified the public within a few days that the disappearance was suspicious. The Amber Alert was quickly cancelled. I think it was cancelled because they didn't believe it was a case of kidnapping from the grandparents. The police also let the public know that they really had no leads in the whereabouts of the grandparents and missing grandson. Within the first few days in July, however, it seems that they were on to something. So here's just a little bit of background on the Lickniz situation. Alvin's son is married to a woman named Patty, who is the sister of a man named Douglas Garland. Garland worked with the father and son years before the disappearance. He was doing some wiring work on a pump that they were trying to develop for the oil fields. Essentially, they had a patent for this pump. But the relationship between the trio quickly soured when Garland stopped taking calls from the father and son. Essentially, they fired him or found someone else to do the work. And I'm probably simplifying the whole relationship, but that's sort of the gist of it. The relationship they had for work began in 2006 and all but ended in 2007. Now, when his parents and nephew went missing, Alan informed the police of this situation, I'm assuming following the standard question about knowing anyone who would wish harm to his parents. On July 4th, the police informed the public that they can confirm what was already suspected by many. A violent crime took place inside the home, and someone or multiple people sustained injuries. According to a 2014 CBC article, the police remained hopeful that Nathan and his grandparents were still alive, but admitted that based on the evidence found in the house, that someone clearly would have been in medical distress. The police also released a video of a green Ford F-150 that was from the late 80s or early 90s. This truck had been spotted driving around the area several times during the night of the disappearance and was captured on CCTV footage. Around that time, Kathy and Alvin's neighbors spoke out to the media and expressed their shock about what had happened, stating that Kathy and Alvin were just nice, normal people. Now, following the release of the information about the truck, Patty, who's Alan's wife and Garland's sister, recognized the green truck that was seen in the area the night of the disappearance. She knew her brother drove a similar-looking truck and had a relationship with the Licknesses. She reported this to the police. On July 5th, the police search and rescue began looking around Kathy and Alvin's home, but they also began to search a property in Airdrie, Alberta. The police did confirm that the search was linked to the disappearance. They took Douglas Garland in for questioning as a person of interest linked to the property they were searching. He ended up being held on an identity fraud charge. On July 15th, he was formally charged with the first-degree murder of Kathy and Alvin and the second-degree murder of Nathan, according to a 2014 CBC article. But where were the bodies? An arrest was made and charges were laid, and though it's not unheard of for this to happen without a body, it's not a common occurrence. Garland was known to the police prior to this terrible crime, but not for anything of that nature. According to a Calgary Herald article from 2014, the property that the police were searching had been raided by the police in 1992. Garland had had a drug lab on the property. He actually managed to evade police for 7 years following this raid. He did so by assuming the identity of a 14-year-old boy who died in the 80s and had escaped to BC, where he'd been living. I think back in the 90s, it was probably easier to assume someone's identity. I think there's a lot of ways to find people now. I'm not saying it's impossible. I've never actually looked into anything like that. But I think back in the 90s, getting away that way was probably a bit easier. Garland was caught in 1999 and was given a 39-month sentence for the crimes. So this crime with the drug lab was actually linked to the original identity theft charge that he was given while they were investigating the disappearance of Nathan and his grandparents. So the charge was for the use of the 14-year-old boy's identity that Garland had assumed while evading police. The police continued to search for evidence and for bodies, but unfortunately there were no bodies to be found. It came out during the trial that DNA from Kathy, Alvin, and Nathan was found on some rubber boots and some tools discovered on the Airdrie property linked to Garland. And this is according to a 2017 Calgary Herald article. An expert at the trial testified that biological material belonging to Kathy and Alvin was found inside and around a burn barrel found on the property. Fragments of bone and teeth, including one that was identified as a baby tooth, was found inside the barrel. I think the most shocking evidence, all of it is shocking, but I think the most shocking of all turned out to be some aerial photos that were taken. So there was a surveying company flying over the area on July 1st and 2nd in 2014, and they flew over the Airdrie property. When the photos taken of that area were blown up, you could see two adult bodies laying face down on the ground and a third smaller body close by. Aerial photos of the same area taken the next day show nothing of the sort. Between that and the evidence found in the burn barrel, I think it's pretty easy to figure out what happened and how he, I'm sorry to even say that, but how he disposed of the bodies. Garland was ultimately found guilty of three counts of first-degree murder in February 2017. Due to the brutality of the crimes, the level of premeditation, and lack of remorse, he was sentenced to 75 years in jail without the possibility of parole, according to a 2017 CBC article. So if I understand correctly, that would be three consecutive life sentences. In 2020, he tried to appeal the sentence, according to a CTV News article. His lawyer stated that the sentence was excessive and harsh. So Garland would be 129 before he could apply for parole, which basically means he would be spending the remainder of his life in prison. The Crown, however, says it was a heinous crime and his sentence still stands. I don't think many people feel badly for the fact that this is probably a harsher sentence than what's usually given as a life sentence in Canada. We usually hear that it's 25 years, or if it's for more than one murder, it would be running concurrent and not consecutive. So 25, but the three are running at the same time, let's say. It's really hard. Actually, it's pretty much impossible for me to feel any sympathy for the man. I think that I've stated this before on the podcast, I don't believe in the death penalty. I do believe in rehabilitation, but I don't think that it's possible to atone for a crime like he committed. Killing three people after a patent dispute, and this was years later, like 7 years after this dispute had taken place, a child that was just an innocent bystander. I don't think 75 years is unreasonable. I remember, and I suspect most Canadians remember hearing about this case, but I actually didn't follow it all the way to the verdict. I do think justice was served as best as it could in this case, and my heart and my sympathies go out to the family and friends of the victims. So, we're going to wind down tonight with a moment of kindness. For tonight's moment, I would like to actually thank all my family and friends who've helped me out on the podcast. Everyone has been really supportive and helpful with their words, their comments, and sometimes even jumping in as a co-host at the last minute. I think I've received a lot of kindness from people around me, and the help and support definitely means a lot. When I started the podcast, I actually said that getting about 500 downloads a week within the first year would make the work and effort worth it. At the moment, we're actually getting about double that, so about 1,000 downloads per week. And I'm very thankful to everyone who's been listening. I know there's a lot of content out there, so thank you for taking the time to listen to us. And also to all the people who've reached out with comments and stories, who've left reviews. It really makes doing the podcast worth the work. It is quite time consuming, but that definitely makes it worth the time. As always, thank you for listening. I hope everyone is staying safe out there. Have a good night. If you like the podcast and could take a moment to share, review, and subscribe, we would greatly appreciate it. You can reach us at crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com. Please feel free to submit a story for our weekly dose of kindness, and we might pick your story to read on the podcast. You can also send me suggestions for local mysteries or crimes that you would like to see featured on our show. We can also be found on our Instagram page, Crime and Mystery Canada.